Una Questione Pubblica by Cheshire Fox. Read by Cookie Mom, 6067. Chapter 1. Milton wakes up cold and alone, with a mouthful of grass and an incredibly heavy heart. A strange energy thrums under his flesh, and as consciousness slowly returns, he finds the absence of pain bewildering. After gaining control of his limbs again, Milton pushes himself up on shaking hands to sit on his knees and take stock of his surroundings. He's on a hill, the cold humidity of the grass dampening his trousers, surrounded by an eerie quiet. The clouds obscure his vision, a thick fog making it impossible to see beyond a few feet. Looking down at himself, at the filthy state of his clothes, he sees holes littering the fabric. Something wet surrounds every single one of them. Milton is sure it is blood, disguised by the deep red of his sweater. And yet, when he pushes fingers underneath the cloth to inspect the damage, he finds no wound, only smooth, unmarred skin. The man fights through the current murkiness of his mind in order to find an explanation for his continued existence, but his memory provides nothing. He does know how he got into this situation. Milton, desolate after losing his sole chance of rescuing his best friend, had been stupid enough to return to the now dilapidated estate that was once Fulvia's home, only to be met with a swarm of fascists. He tried to flee through the fields before realizing an escape would be nigh impossible. However, he refused to give those damn roaches neither the opportunity to torture him for information nor the satisfaction of killing him. Had been intent on taking his own life, but fate seemed to have a twisted sense of humor. Not only had he dropped his gun during all of that running, but his next option, an explosive-rigged bridge nearby, did not detonate, even as he jumped around the decaying wood like a madman. The roaches still on his heels, he succumbed to desperation. There was no way out. They caught him, shot him point-blank, and left him to rot, probably as a warning to any other partisan who came this way. Just another corpse among the many that littered the green lands of the Lung. Milton should be dead. He surely remembers dying, a sudden cold spreading through his body as if he'd been immersed in the freezing ocean. Everyone says that your whole life flashes before your eyes at the moment of death, but Milton's did not. Instead, he saw glimpses of other lives, other people. A man, scruffy and sad, clutching a bottle like a lifeline. Another. This one livelier and well-groomed, but with the same weariness etched into his handsome face. A woman with the secrets of the world in her eyes and its weight on her shoulders. He had never met these people, and yet they were with him as life seeped out of his body. And now he stands unscathed and perplexed on the site of his demise. Santa Maria, Madre de Dio. Milton is not sure he still believes in God, but he crosses himself anyway. Chapter 2. They part ways when news of the invasion in Poland reaches them. After promising to convene 5 years from then in neutral Switzerland, Andrea and Booker throw themselves directly into the battlefront, while Joseph works behind the scenes alongside the French intelligence at their behest, with his very much un-Aryan looks to remain in Allied territory as a safer bet than crossing enemy lines. Unfortunately, that plan becomes moot as things turn hopeless quite quickly. By June 1940, German troops are advancing on Paris, and Joseph goes underground. When staying in the city becomes no longer an option, he flees with help from some friends in the resistance and ends up joining the Free French Army in Algeria as a colonial soldier, an easily fabricated identity. Unable to communicate with Andrea and Booker before the appointed time, he spends 3 years fighting in North Africa, moving from troop to troop whenever his immortality is in danger of being discovered due to injury or him dying in front of the other soldiers. He finds companionship at every new unit, his Tunisian countrymen in one, the charismatic Martinicans in another. They all provide bittersweet moments among the harsh yet familiar reality of war. The colonial soldiers are already bound by shared experiences with their pampered, prejudiced, and ignorant French-born companions. Therefore, any common ground discovered after has a solid foundation. It had been a while since Joseph had last seen battle. Every year since he first fell on the scorching sands outside Jerusalem, he had walked further away from the path of violence, scarred by each atrocity he witnessed in the Crusades and all that came after. He can't even bear to don the chosen symbol of the free forces, the Cross of Lorraine, too similar to the blood-red sigil that still haunts his nightmares. Yet he knows these are dire times. The guilt would eat him alive if he did nothing to aid the war effort against the Axis, and if that means expelling fascists from the Mediterranean, so be it. Joseph spends 3 years doing that, anxiously waiting for the time to reunite with the others. He worries for Andrea and Booker, hopes that they are taking care of each other out there in the front, if the two of them are still there. It's 1943, and as the end of September draws near, his unit leaves African shores. They sail from Algiers to liberate Corsica from German control. The grueling days at sea a harder battle than what awaits them on the shore, seeing as Hitler had ordered the evacuation of the island days before. The dream comes soon after the region is retaken, startling him awake in the middle of the night. Another one. A man, terrified and desperate, shot like a dog. Joseph feels his fear, feels the pain of the bullets and the icy grip of death seizing his heart. He suppresses a shout of surprise as he shoots up in his cot, trying not to wake the rest of the barracks, clutching at his stomach to chase the phantom wounds. After regaining enough wakefulness, his hands fly to the regulation jacket at his bedside, rummaging its pockets for his notebook and pencil. Attempting to steady trembling fingers, he traces what he glimpsed of the new immortal's features. A strong jaw, a Roman nose, bowed lips. Unfortunately, Joseph hadn't gotten a good look at the upper half of his face, so he leaves it halfway done and focuses on the man's body and the background. Dirty clothes, wide hands scrambling to push himself up a hill, fog, green grass. He was being chased by black-clad men, who Joseph recognized as Camice Nere, fascist grunts. His pencil runs across the page, and the portrait is finished within minutes, even in the low light of the barracks, rough but precise enough for the little he had to go on. Looking at the half-man trapped within the page, Joseph can't help but think him handsome. He also seems so, so very young, and yet embroiled in violence, surely connected to the war. Just as he finishes adding a dark mole to the man's chin, a movie star's beauty mark, he thinks, a shuffling sound to his right alerts him of his comrade's awareness. Thankfully, it's only Larussi. The easygoing Algerian had been one to share moments going beyond simple companionship, and was used enough to Joseph's artistically insomniac ways that he won't bat an eye at him drawing other men in the middle of the night. He rises to his elbows to peek bleary-eyed at the notebook. "Who's that?" the soldier croaks, raising a lazy eyebrow at him. Joseph smiles minutely, not taking his eyes off the page. "A friend." Later, after morning has reached Ajaccio, Joseph tries to piece together the facts as he goes about his routine. He must find the man as soon as possible and maybe use the new one's own dreams to find out about Booker's and Andrea's whereabouts. There's a chance those two are thinking the same, preparing to go after him themselves. Joseph knows the man is in Italy, that profile and his murderer's clear indicators, but Italy is still a big country. How will he find him? The new immortal had died in the wilderness, presumably away from society, surrounded by nothing that could hint at his location. He wishes Andrea was here, with her tracking expertise. But even then, you can't track visions. Joseph had dabbled in botany and textiles for at least a century, but he could have millennia under his belt and still be unable to identify the precise origin of the bushes or the cotton used in the man's clothes. The two of them had only found Booker as fast as they did because they happened to be in Russia at the time, following the trail of destruction left by Napoleon's army. Before that, it had taken years for Andrea and Quinn. Oh, Quinn. Joseph's heart constricts at the memory of the woman. To track down and catch up to their new brother, who is lost and confused loitering around in Baghdad. He'll have to wait for another dream. Over the course of the next few weeks, more pieces are added to the puzzle. An old church, a familiar gun, a whispered language, a recognizable landscape. More pages of Joseph's notebook are used, filled with marble-cut features and scenes from an empty countryside. A tiny fragment of Occitan heard one night confirms his suspicions, and he starts making preparations. It's well into October when Joseph absconds from the island in stolen plain clothes and a small, inconspicuous fishing boat, sneaking away from the camp in the dead of night lest he be caught and tried as a deserter, leaving behind only his uniform and a cryptic farewell and well wishes to LaRussi. He has dealt with drowning and starvation many times, but still allows himself to hope the few rations he brings with him will last and that the sea keeps its calm until he reaches the coast of Liguria. The rations end by the middle of the journey, and a storm hits by its last leg, but Joseph steps foot on the shores of Imperia in one piece. From there he makes his way into Piedmont, careful not to get too close to any city or settlement, and living off river water, wild berries, and unattended orchards. As Joseph slowly advances into the country, the dream's locations begin changing rapidly. Before, the man had hid somewhere as he, hopefully, came to terms with his new condition, the walls of a decrepit little chapel being a constant background for the visions. But now it is clear that he's on the move. "He knows I'm coming," Joseph thinks, after settling for a night under the wilderness's protection, curled between the tree roots. "He's coming to meet me." If that's the case, the man is already more put together than he was all those years ago. He had spent almost 50 years running away, thinking he was being hunted by vengeful ghosts, not a decision burdened with intelligence, as Andrea so loved to remind him. Booker had also thought they were ghosts, but he had the excuse of being completely delirious for days after his death. The huff of laughter brought forth by the images of his family echoes in the darkness of the woods. The oldest man in the world lays his head on the sturdy trunk at his back, trying to get as comfortable as he possibly can, sitting on the cold, hard ground while waiting to be taken by exhaustion. He dreams of the sea, trapped in a man's eyes. They are there when he wakes up, along with the barrel of a gun. Chapter 3. Milton's first coherent thought, after the literal and metaphorical fog subsides, is confusion. Wobbling down the steep hill, almost testing fate once more by nearly slipping and tumbling the rest of the way to save ground several times, he tries to find a plausible explanation for his newfound resilience. His constitution has failed him since infancy. Milton has had to fight his way through a common cold. How on God's earth can he survive a bullet? As logic fails him, all that is left to do is to accept his own death. Milton, pragmatic to a fault, has to cling to the plain facts. The men shot him. Therefore, he must be dead. Nothing more to it. He is now a ghost, doomed by an unfulfilled promise to roam the land in search of his friend. A sound explanation in his addled mind. But then he trips on an exposed root and falls face first on a moss-covered rock. The sound of his skull cracking like an egg echoes through the empty field, and Milton is again overtaken by blinding agony. With the little clarity he has, the man can only bemoan his inconceivable bad luck as he writhes on the grass, until to his astonishment the pain begins to fade away. He feels the splintered bones of his face arrange themselves under his flesh, fusing to how they were before the fall, feels the lacerations made by the hard stone slowly disappear beneath curious fingers, his skin stitching together by what surely must be magic. Completely dazed, he proceeds aimlessly towards whatever direction his feet favor, head full of questions. He doesn't know how long he walks, but as the sky darkens further and further, he comes across a graying chapel. It's a small, battered thing, abandoned, just like most of the buildings scattered around the countryside. Milton barely makes it across the small fence surrounding the property when the sharp sound of a rifle being cocked stops him in his tracks. He almost reaches for the missing revolver in his pants before catching himself and raising his empty hands in surrender. Making no sudden movements, he waits for the gunman to come out of the shadows. If it's another roach, Dio, please not more roaches, then his miracle will have to keep for a third time. Who are you? The person shouts, the tremble at the end of the question betraying their nerves. What do you want? A fascist would have incapacitated or killed him already, so Milton allows himself to relax minutely. I am unarmed. Please, I only sought shelter. There's a sound of shuffling behind him before he feels the cold press of a barrel on his back, and Milton tenses all over again. Walk. It's not a request. Milton obeys, not too keen on experiencing the bite of a bullet again, and lets himself be forcefully herded through the chapel's creaking doors. Please, Milton continues, I just... Shut up! The pressure on his back disappears, the gunmen backing away from him as they cross the threshold. Turn around. Slowly he heeds and comes face to face with the scraggly-looking white-bearded man and a rusty gun. He's clad in a worn brown coat with visible tears and has a tired face and hard eyes. His wrinkled hands shake minutely where they grip the gun. Under the low light emanating from the single candle stuck into a crease in the wall near the doors, the man squints as he inspects his captive more closely, gun still at the ready. Partigiano, he asks with a tilt of the barrel. Milton hesitates before nodding. The few who remain in the poor countryside have no love lost for fascists. There might be some compassion for a rebel hidden in the nooks and crannies of the old chapel. The same compassion he found with his parents, still distraught with worry in Alba, with Concetta, who gave him all she had to eat, with the brave pregnant woman in the field, who hid him from sight, and with Fulvia's governess, who unwittingly set in motion his search for Giorgio in the first place. Curious eyes take in Milton's disheveled state, the holes in his clothes, the dried blood on his pale skin. Frowning, the man lowers his weapon. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, boy, what happened to you? Milton has asked himself the same question and wishes he had an answer. All he knows now is that he'd kill for a cigarette. As it turns out, the man doesn't require one in order to put his guard down, if only by a fraction. Taking the exhausted Partigiano further into the building, he shows him to the little one-room rectory adjacent to the chapel, leaving him to divest himself of his ruined clothes. He does his best to remove the dirt from his skin with the cold water basin left there and covers his shivering body with the blanket strewn around the simple straw bed shoved in the corner. Milton is so tired he doesn't even consider hiding the bullet holes scattered on his undershirt, the blood-stained whiteness a clear evidence of what had befallen him. He leaves it on the floor for the man to find when he returns, carrying some spare garments, his curious prodding of it prompting Milton to think of a quick explanation. It's not mine, he says before the man can voice his astonishment at the lack of wounds when the fabric is so damaged. I had to take it from a friend. The mere implication of a followed comrade is enough to soften the man a bit more. Pushing the clean, or at least cleaner, clothes into Milton's arms, he moves to sit on the bed, the warm frame groaning under his weight. He assesses him again, and Milton, making no move to put on the sweater and shirt, meets his calculating gaze with trepidation. What brings you here, my friend? The man asks. I was looking for someone. Was? Am. Milton swallows around the painful lump in his throat. He was taken, not 3 days ago. The man hums, leaning on the cracked stone wall behind him. You'll be lucky to find him alive then. The roaches work fast. Milton has no response to that. He knows, has been thinking about everything Giorgio has suffered at the hands of the fascists by now, and how death can only come as a relief for his obstinate, dutiful friend. The rebel's silence spreads to every corner of the room, bathing the ambient in tension. The man seems to realize that auguring the death of a comrade is not the best course of action, and opts to change the subject. "You can stay here for a night or two. The Roaches have no interest in an old beggar like me. They don't come this way often." Instinct tells Milton to be suspicious. Experience tells him that kindness can be everywhere, even if in small doses. He gladly takes the offer. The man does not volunteer his name, but neither does the rebel. It's better this way. In the chapel, he can finally lick his non-existent wounds and have a moment to breathe. Immensely grateful, Milton gobbles up the stale bread and the soup shared with him, drinks the milk from the single goat the man keeps like he hasn't had a drop of water in years. Afterwards, his host leads him back to the entrance and points him to the altar. It is a strange place to sleep, but Milton has rested on worse a place than a blanket-covered stone floor. The man leaves him there to seek his own slumber, and as he lays down, the exhaustion of these past few days finally catches up to the rebel. He doesn't remember falling asleep. He doesn't dream. Milton wakes up in the early morning with much difficulty, struggling to move his lead-filled limbs to prop himself up on his elbows and properly take stock of his surroundings. The eerie quiet is stifling, forcefully trapping him with his own thoughts. His host's words keep echoing in his head. It has been 3 days since Giorgio was taken, and some hours since he ruined his last chance of saving him. What use could the fascists still have for him? Milton knows it doesn't take long for a captured Partigiano to be put before the firing squad, wealthy family or not. Cazzo. Hands move to tangle in his hair, nails digging painfully into his scalp as he hunches over. Feeling a sudden wetness running down his cheeks, Milton realizes he is crying. Salty tears, a distillation of both anger and grief. What will I tell Fulvia? Will I even see her again? If I do, how can I ever face her? He stays frozen like that for a while, bowed as if in pain, but feeling completely empty, surrounded by the cold phantasmagorial walls of the chapel, a very fitting place for a ghost. It is only later, after minutes or hours, he doesn't know, his sense of time is waning, as is his spirit, that his host comes looking for him, interrupting his martyrization process. He doesn't utter a word and stands silent near the altar Milton had slept under, gaze fixed on the ground, in order to give him at least a semblance of privacy as the younger man recomposes himself. Milton scrambles to wipe his tears, blood under his nails, and gets up to face the man. "Good morning," he says, voice hoarse. The older man only grunts in reply. He holds two chipped mugs of steaming coffee and offers one to him, gesturing for the partigiano to join him in one of the remaining pews. They drink quietly for some minutes before the older man finally cracks and asks the question Milton suspects has been on the tip of his tongue since he held him at gunpoint. "What is going on out there?" Milton hasn't much to tell him, only the same platitudes he told Concetta in an attempt to give her hope. The Roaches are getting sloppy. The government is getting weaker. By May, the war will end and they'll be free. The man takes it all in with more skepticism than her, Milton's own cynicism reflected in his eyes, but does not contradict him. The rest of the day doesn't fully register in the rebel's mind. His host keeps him occupied with menial tasks, asking him to feed the chickens and help him tend to the little garden he has managed to grow beside the chapel's small graveyard. Yet the work is not enough to center him, and when night arrives once more, he returns to the altar with more muted thanks and hollowed eyes. He lays down on the blanket, feeling empty and unbearably lost, and waits for a hopefully dreamless sleep to take him away. He should know by now that things have a habit of not going his way. The visions return. Without the overpowering panic of death, Milton can parse through them more clearly. The strangers from before are fleeting images dancing under his eyelids, this time outside of the simple vacuum the rebel had first glimpsed them in. The blonde man, that haunted look in his eyes even more pronounced now, grips a small silver flask with trembling hands. He's big and broad, reminiscent of many now-grown schoolmates of his, the ones who ended up on the other side of this fight. He's slumped inside a half-destroyed building, debris scattered all around. Leaning on a solitary wall by his side is the woman, hard gaze trained on the floor. Strangely, she's dressed in quilted military garb. Both of them are. He can't see much of her body or face, obscured as they are, only her short, dark hair and her ramrod straight posture. The man and the woman appear to be in the middle of a lukewarm argument, mouths moving fast but eyes not meeting. But Milton only catches the unintelligible tail end of the harsh French thrown between them before the two fade away completely. Then, the other man strolls into his subconscious, perched on a moss-covered slab of stone. He overlooks the vast expanse of the sea, watching the dark water and all the stars it reflects, a thousand thoughts swirling in his deep brown eyes. A light breeze brushes his face, and Milton swears he can feel it against his own. The man is also clad in a military uniform, the plain beige made pretty simply by resting over his strong frame. There's movement behind him, other soldiers going about their route, but they're all ignored as the man's attention turns to the journal in his hands, charcoal-smudged fingers running down its cover. In a flash, the pages are right in front of Milton's eyes, as if the stranger's vision is his own, and before he can process what he sees, everything fades. He wakes up to the morning light seeping through a crack in the stone wall, the image of his own sullen face staring back at him seared into his mind. Chapter 4. You'd think that after centuries of living in almost constant peril, Joseph's body would be primed for detecting danger from miles away. Alas, once a heavy sleeper, always a heavy sleeper. "Who are you?" asks the trembling voice behind the carcano currently being shoved into his face. At least it's Italian and not Occitan. He's pretty rusty with that one. Joseph's pack tumbles out of his lap as he releases it from his sleepy grip to raise his arms in a placating gesture. He can't form words just yet, too busy squinting at his attacker trying to make out his face in the remaining darkness of the early morning, beyond the sunrise catching eyes looking down at him with anxious anticipation. Not that he needs to. After 2 weeks of dreams, he is already quite familiar with those paradoxically hard and soft features. Joseph clears his throat, wetting his lips to buy time while getting his thoughts in order. Depends on who's asking, and whether they are pointing a gun at me. His casual answer throws the man off, and the immortal makes use of the split second where his grip on the gun falters to strike, shoving the barrel aside, lightning fast, and lunging at his hands to wrestle it away. The man barely has any time to process the movements, finding himself unarmed before he can do so much as blink or let out a surprised shout. Joseph doesn't bother turning the gun on him, using it instead as a crutch as he rises from under the cedar tree. That's better. Now we can... As soon as he is standing on 2 feet, the man is on him, pulling at the lapels of his coat to topple him to the ground. Joseph did not expect the new one to have this much fight in him, and silently debates if his actions are annoying or endearing as he throws the gun away and drags the man down with him by the sleeves of his tattered sweater. They grapple over the dry leaves scattered on the ground, one trying to get the other to let go. Neither of them are at the epitome of their strength, with Joseph surviving only on small rations for the last few days, and the man not faring any better, if the leanness he feels under his grip is any indication. However, Joseph had his experience on his side, and soon gets the upper hand, overpowering his opponent and rolling on top of him. Trapping the man's legs between his own, Joseph takes hold of his wrists and pins them to his chest. He can feel the erratic heartbeat pulsing from beneath. "Stop!" Joseph grits out at his struggling captive. The man refuses to listen, and Joseph finds himself losing patience.
"Why ask questions if you don't want to wait for an answer?"
Twisting to reach behind himself, he pulls out the knife hidden in his boots with his free hand and brings it up to the other's face. The man freezes at the sight of the blade.
What are you doing?" he gasps.
Joseph straightens up, putting more weight on his grip as he tenses his arm. "Don't be afraid. Just watch." Slowly, he runs the knife down his forearm, the skin parting with ease under the sharp metal, eyes glued to the other's face. The man sucks in a startled breath as a small rivulet of blood trickles down, but just as quickly as the cut was made, it fades. A few drops of blood, warm and slick, mark his own skin and stain his clothes, but he pays no mind to it. He watches with wide eyes as the wound disappears, a spark of recognition flashing within them.
"I am like you."
Joseph carefully releases him. Movement slow and deliberate, as if to soothe the wild beast, and pushes himself up to stand over him. Frozen on the ground, the man watches as the knife in his grip falls to the dirt.
"And what am I?"
he chokes out, breathless. The older immortal smiles at the wondrous curiosity fused with confusion in his melodious voice.
"Many things, I'm sure," he answers, extending a hand in offering.
Brown eyes find green, and the man's fingers surge up to meet his. They fall away from Joseph's grip as he takes a step back. Brushing off the dirt caught in his hair, Joseph returns to his tree under a now incredulous aquamarine stare that prickles at the back of his neck. With a grunt, he sits down on one of the cedar's particularly stout, exposed roots and gestures for the man to join him, but the other doesn't budge, hands now clenched at his sides.
"What's your name?"
That gets him a downward tilt of the man's mouth, probably a sign that his patience is running out. The older immortal gives him a strained smile, acknowledging his frustration, but knows things will be better once they get the introductions out of the way. "I am Yusuf ibn Ibrahim ibn Muhammad ibn al-Khazani, called al-Tayyib. Joseph, for now." A frown this time, the expression tight across his face. Joseph raises an eyebrow, waiting for something in return.
"Milton," the man says after another brief bout of considering silence. "Just Milton."
"A nom de guerre, most likely." It is what he expected. Trust is not built after a single tussle in the dirt, after all.
"Milton."
He tests the name on his tongue, thinking it too anglicized for one with such a regal nose, but refraining from commenting.
"All right, Milton. I assume that by now you've noticed that you can't die."
The man steps closer, agitation morphing into unfounded anger.
"Is this your doing? Why am I... Why are we like this?"
"This is no one's doing. And trust me, I have spent many, many years looking for an explanation for our condition and have yet to find it." That last part gives him pause.
"How many exactly?"
Joseph scratches at the underside of his chin, nails catching in his growing stubble.
900, give or take.
Even under the low light of dawn, he can see Milton's eyes widen as he tries to make sense of his age.
900 years? You are close to 1,000 years old."
"And so might you be one day."
"Dio."
Milton sways on his feet, hands moving to press against his face. Too distressed to keep himself steady, he takes Joseph's invite and perches beside him, head bowed. The older immortal fights the urge to reach out and ease the tension between his brows with his fingers.
I know it is a lot to take in. I had hoped to do this differently, in a better place, perhaps, but... He trails off, hoping his words can offer at least a fraction of the comfort he wishes he could give him. But I found you first. Milton's voice is quiet, yet raw, almost drowned out by the rustle of the leaves above them. It was not hard. Not once I realized the visions were not just strange dreams. Smart. Already doing better than him and Booker. Joseph wonders what tipped him off. Well, maybe this is for the best, seeing as I was still elaborating a plan of approach. He waits for Milton to look at him from the corner of his eyes before smiling, elated to see the corner of the man's mouth twitch in response. They spend a handful of minutes in silence, allowing Milton a moment to think under the surrounding crickets' faint chirps and the other sounds of the awaking clearing. When he finally turns to face him, Joseph can almost hear the fuming gears turning in his head. I saw others in my visions. Are they like us too? Yes, Andrea and Booker. Where are they? I know they are in some front, but... He shrugs. I can't place any details. I don't know where they are either. Was hoping you could help me find them, actually. Joseph stretches his coiled muscles with a groan, arching his back and raising his arms in a covert attempt to release the stress still trapped in his body from their little fight. We separated at the start of the war. They were heading to Poland last time I saw them. Curious gleam back in his eyes, Milton leans closer, probably not even noticing he's doing it. Are they as old as you? Booker wasn't half that curious when we found him, Joseph thinks with amusement. No. Booker is the youngest after you. Almost 150. And Andrea, well, she refuses to tell, but she has many, many centuries on me. That throws the man for another loop, unable to form another question with his mouth halfway open in shock. Joseph can only chuckle sympathetically at his bewilderment. My thoughts exactly. Milton rubs at his eyes with enough force to be painful. All right, he mumbles. A millennia-old woman, the things she must have seen. His hands fall away, and when he looks at Joseph once again, the older immortal wonders how he ever thought he could capture that gaze. None of his drawings did the real thing justice. The intensity too strong, the colors too volatile to ever be a still image on the page. But oh, does he want to try? Distracted as he might be by those eyes, Joseph is sure Milton's low tones can cut through any line of thought. The things you must have seen. 900 years. His face is a battlefield of emotions, wonder, sadness, and apprehension fighting to be the one to prevail. Releasing Joseph from his scrutiny to stare unfocused ahead, he clutches at his knees, the fabric straining under his grip. Unwilling to let the man lose his mind by thinking himself into circles, Joseph abandons his resolve and reaches out to place a hand on Milton's shoulder. The other man startles at the touch, pulling his shoulders back and drawing up to his full height as if expecting an attack. Easy. I promise you are safe with me, my friend. Hesitation shines in his eyes for a fraction of a second before a shuddering breath leaves Milton's lips. His own hand surges up to cover Joseph's, anchoring himself in the touch. Now, he continues, why don't we get out of here? Chapter 5. From the moment he woke up on that foggy hill, Milton's mind has been reeling with questions. From the moment the man in his dreams pinned him to the ground and bled for him, the answers leave it in almost the exact same state. Just like you. Joseph, or Yusuf, or one of the many names Milton was afraid to mispronounce, had said. Healing, undying, immortal. However, he was provided with no explanation for their condition, no clear reason, no purpose. We died, we came back, was all his new companion had to offer. Fighting is the only link between us all. It was. By the man's accounts, all who shared this gift died either in battle or as a direct result of one. Joseph did not go into detail about the others' deaths, saying it was not his place. The visions had provided Milton no such privacy. His own demise broadcasted like a nightly radio special to absolute strangers. They had been making their way through the rolling hills of the Langa for the better part of the day, moving silently and quickly, and hoping no fascist crossed their path, and now had found a place to break more words undisturbed. "We dream of each other until we meet," Joseph says. Once they settle beneath the shadow of what once must have been a barn, its wood walls scorched and the surrounding stone fence in pieces. "I suppose we are meant to be together." It's almost poetic. The man surely has an artistic soul, what with his carefully constructed words and charcoal-smudged fingers. He reminds Milton of the many novels and poetry books in Fulvia's library, and the many hours he spent going through them under her and Giorgio's mirthful presence. He wonders if Joseph likes Wuthering Heights, too. Milton pulls out his cigarette pack. One last kindness from the man at the chapel, given at his departure. As important as the old gun lent to him, if not more. Days after his initially proposed shelter time. There's only one left. The partigiano lights it between his lips and takes a drag before offering it to Joseph. Their fingers brush as he takes it, the brief warmth from the touch sending a spark running up his chilled skin. "You drew me," Milton interrupts, the comfortable, uncomfortable silence between them. "I saw it in my dreams. That's how I knew you were real." He had woken up in cold sweat the night he saw his face in Joseph's notebook, knowing the chances of the visions being a figment of his imagination were slim. After all, he was never the creative sort. Giorgio was the one with a penchant for fantasy, while he was content to simply enjoy what had already been conceived. Joseph takes a long drag of the cigarette, tilting his head up to let the billowing smoke escape his lips. "I did. Had to, really. Your face is perfect for portraits." He snorts at that, an ugly, cynical sound that escapes his nose and echoes in the quiet. "What? Are the proportions good practice?" The other man frowns at him as if confused by his statement. "Not at all. I only meant that your features were made to be drawn, or carved into stone." Milton was not expecting that. Most comments he received on his appearance were either critical or derogatory. His nose too big, his eyes too sinister, his hair too dull, his body too awkward. To be compared to art is a first, and he acutely feels the heat taking over his face. Thankfully, Joseph does not call attention to it, letting the subject fall by the wayside. "I must ask," he says, after yet another lull in their conversation, "what are you planning on doing now?" Now it's Milton's turn to frown. He was under the impression that Joseph had already mapped their future, and while he did not fully trust him, Milton assumed the older man would try to take him wherever he wanted, with or without his assent. Joseph's wish to know his intentions takes him by surprise. Milton had contemplated his options before, during his stay in the chapel. His first thought had been to return to Treviso, to his brigade. Surely his inability to die could help their campaign and spare many others from what should have been his own fate. He tried to picture his commander's reaction if he were to reveal it all. Frank would not believe him, at least not without witnessing it for himself. They are alike in this aspect, both prone to doubt absent concrete proof. Milton also considered going back home and seeing his parents again, but he immediately quashed his longing. He would only put them in danger, as a partigiano and as an immortal. Having found Joseph, things are even more complicated. He barely knows what he would tell his comrades if he comes back after days away with a stranger in tow. "I don't know," Milton answers honestly. Before, he had avoided thinking beyond rescuing his friend, too focused on getting him back to Fulvia, or getting himself back to Fulvia. Now that those possibilities have been destroyed, he must face the future. At least he's not alone. I suppose we can't stay here. Joseph doesn't answer, his gaze returning to the skies. Milton follows the lines in the corner of his eyes as he squints at the little sunlight coming from behind the clouds. Do you have family here? The older man inquires. In Alba, my parents. With a quiet exhale, he lets his head drop, not looking at Milton. If Andrea were here, she would tell you to never see them again. She's practical like that. And what would you say? The man shrugs. Good question. I think her advice is one to be followed. Seeing your loved ones age and die while you remain unchanging will bring you nothing but pain and unwanted attention. Discovery always ends badly for us, and there are fates much worse than death out there. He turns to Milton, but the Partigiano is not his focus, the intense stare phasing through him. He pulls his lower lip between his teeth, absently chewing on it as he falls deeper into his thoughts. But could I ask that of you? Milton appreciates the other man's empathy, the clear tender-heartedness he sees displayed on his expressive face, but knows they mustn't waste time on possibilities. You wouldn't be the first to do so. The resistance had asked the same, and Joseph knows that. His parents would probably think him dead already had they not seen each other only some days ago in that brief encounter in the town. Milton's heart clenches painfully, deep within his chest. Maybe that would be best. Turning away, he can feel the weight of Joseph's scrutiny. And they wouldn't be the first to lose a son in this mess, or the last. He hears the other man take a breath beside him, mulling over his next words. I went back to my family after my first death. He offers the cigarette back to Milton, who lets it hang limp between his lips, anticipating. The man had shared little of his past beyond his age. It took years. The journey was a long one, both physically and mentally, and by the time I arrived on the front steps of my childhood home, he trails off with a tired sigh. And Milton wonders if memories as old as those would one day haunt him as well, centuries from now. They had gotten word of my death, had grieved and suffered, and they had moved on. They had found happiness again, still cherishing me, but not bound to a phantom anymore. He shifts on the small half-collapsed stone wall they had both perched on, the movement reluctantly pulling Milton's gaze to him once again. There's a fire in the other man's dark eyes, drowned by the ghosts of his past, but still there, and the Partigiano is suddenly hit by the realization that this is the oldest man on earth. I wouldn't be the one to bring it all back. Couldn't ruin what they built. The corner of his mouth twitches, either up or downwards, Milton can't tell. But I regret it sometimes. Maybe the time I could have with them would be worth it, right? Resting on his leg, Joseph's fingers twitch, and Milton knows he wants to reach out like he did back in that clearing. Feels both relief and disappointment when he refrains from doing so, curling them into his palm instead. You could write to them, Joseph continues. Give them closure. What would your friends think about that? It's a muted little thing, but the older man smirks at that. Well, they aren't here, are they? And it's not really their business if you say goodbye or not. It is their business if they find out about... Milton stutters on the word, still unused to its reality. Are you planning on telling them? At the minute shake of Milton's head, Joseph raises his hands in a there you go gesture. And a small laugh escapes the Partigiano's lips. The rush of air dislodges a cigarette from his mouth, but the older man catches it before it can plummet to his lap or the ground, absently rolling it between his fingers while watching a faint blush stain Milton's uncovered neck. Milton's mouth is still half open, and Joseph chuckles at his dumbfounded expression. The sound is so absurd to his ears, after months marred in gloom and adrenaline, that Milton can't help but mimic it, a full-blown laughter soon rolling off both of them. After the two men manage to calm down, they return to a more serious matter. "We can go look for Andrea and Booker, use your dreams, and leave this all behind," Joseph says, momentary glee all but forgotten and scrubbed from his face. "But if you wish to remain and help your comrades, I'll stay with you and help." "Was he this righteous in his first life?" Milton muses. The Partigiano assumes time transforms all. His only hope is that he'll only improve and not worsen in his eternity. "I want to help. It's his duty. To his parents, to Fulvia, to Giorgio. I want to stay." With a nod, Joseph rises to his feet, the cigarette forgotten atop the wall. "So we will." There's no outstretched hand or comforting touch this time, but Milton guides him to Treviso anyway. It's not an easy feat, finding an excuse for Joseph's presence in the little town. First, Frank welcomes Milton with astonished surprise, since he took his continuous absence as a sign that the roaches had managed to either capture or kill him. That last one a correct assumption. Then his captain turns suspicious eyes upon his new companion. With an explanation crafted beforehand, they weave a tale about Milton finding a Sicilian comrade on the run and deciding to bring him into the fold. "I let you go off to look for an old friend, and you come back with a new one instead." The way the man responds solely with that observation and a solemn nod before rushing to speak with a group of scouts is a testament to his trust in Milton. As they mingle in the camp, the easy southern accent falling from Joseph's mouth prompts Milton to wonder if the region had been a home of his at some point in time. He'll have to ask more about the man's many lives once they find a moment alone in the bustle of his brigade. To Milton's surprise, it's very easy to fall back into the routine he had before leaving on his ill-fated quest, even with the added constant that is Joseph, or Giuseppe, as he's taken to calling him near others, and the need to keep any rapidly healing injury under wraps. He sees his companions again, greets them with more warmth than ever, to the men's bewilderment. He meets the new ones, boys, just as he was one day, inexperienced but eager. He runs messages and keeps watch, and all is as it was. Well, almost all. Joseph is a shadow at his heels most of the time, heavy eyes always on him whenever Milton returns from a mission, always attentive to any pain behind the Partigiano's own. It should be unnerving, or annoying at the very least, but Milton finds the man's support and concern to be a comfort he isn't used to. They make a habit of bunking together, and if Milton's comrades have any thoughts on it, they don't voice them, opting instead for silent exchanges and raised eyebrows between themselves. One of the more quiet nights finds the two immortals laying on the hard wooden floor of the long-abandoned school at the center of the town, sleeping one next to the other beneath an old desk in order to preserve body heat. Snores fill the room as the other partigiani, strewn around them, slumber, completely lost to the world thanks to the wine some of the men brought in earlier that day, the soft sounds lulling Milton and Joseph to sleep. Over the past few days, Milton has had visions of Andrea and Booker almost as soon as he closed his eyes, watching a mangled reel of the two trekking across snowy plains and bloody battlefields, and this night is no different. He sees them huddled over a fire, bundled in layers of fur and surrounded by other soldiers, all laughing merrily at a joke Milton just missed. The scene is a departure from the inner and outward devastation from all the others before, and Milton, in his lethargic dream state, feels the urge to join in their momentary joy. Their cackling then becomes louder and louder, the pitch getting higher, everything echoing in Milton's mind. The bright light of the fire dissolves, and he is suddenly plunged into freezing darkness. The laughter turns into a single scream, muffled but absolutely anguished. A metallic sound rattles in the void, deafening, and Milton feels his lungs fill with water, his throat crushed by an enormous unseen pressure. He's trapped. Hands slam against iron. And when they bleed from the sheer force of the hits, Milton doesn't know if they are his own or someone else's, the pain slicing up his arms like a knife. He opens his mouth to scream, but finds himself muted by both a gripping terror and a lack of oxygen. Milton wakes up mid-thrashing in cold sweat, heart beating wildly inside his chest. His first instinct is to cover in his mouth in order to not rouse anyone else with his frightened gasps as he tries to get his breathing under control, fingers digging into his cheek. For someone who only days ago had been caught unaware by him, Joseph seems attuned enough to Milton that he shoots up from his curled position mere seconds after the Partigiano. "What happened?" he mumbles, hand moving to grab blindly at Milton's arm as he tries to blink the sleep from his eyes. Joseph's grounding touch brings him down from the panic of his dream. The man helps Milton sit up and watches with concern while he presses a palm to his clammy forehead.
I saw..." He swallows, throat dry. "There was a woman. She was trapped somewhere. There was so much water. She was in so much pain. So desperate."
One hand sliding down to cover one eye, he inspects the other, almost expecting to see dark blood staining his knuckles.
"I saw glimpses of her before, but this time I could feel it."
He doesn't look up, but feels Joseph's grip on his arm tighten, hears the shuddering breath the man takes.
"Quinn."
His voice is only a whisper, yet the sheer emotion packed into a single word echoes in the room.
She was one of us. Is one of us. The first immortal Andrea found over 4,000 years ago. They were inseparable, fierce, unstoppable, but then a choke.
Milton raises his head and watches the bob of the man's Adam's apple, the tears quietly running down his cheek. He wants to turn away from such an intimate display of vulnerability, but finds that impossible. They were in England during the witch trials, freeing anyone they could. Joseph goes on, eyes cast down. 16th century, you can imagine how it was. I was practically on the other side of the world, too busy with artistic pursuits and knowledge-seeking. He spits, shaking his head in self-admonishment. Two unkillable women at the hands of religious fanatics. It's not hard to fill the gaps in the older man's silence. Milton remembers flipping through a book or two on the different inquisitions spread throughout Europe and the New World at university, the stamped illustrations of the many tortures used on heretics floating in his mind, crude and graphic. Those people, illuminated by the sliver of moonlight coming from the only window in the room, Joseph's face morphs into something hard, anger in the molten brown of his gaze. When nothing they did managed to kill them, they separated the two. Quinn was locked in an iron coffin and thrown to the seas. Milton recalls the man's words from weeks ago, a fate worse than death. A cold vice winds itself around Milton's heart, and for a moment he's back in the depths.
She's still there. She's drowning over and over down there for centuries.
Joseph nods, fingers carding through his sleep-tousled hair, eyes shut tight as if he's in pain.
How could you leave her? She's going mad in that coffin. It's eternal torture.
The rise in Milton's voice causes a few of the nearby men to stir and mumble in their slumber, but thankfully does nothing more.
We didn't leave her.
Joseph's answer is tired and subdued, as if he's had the same discussion many other times. With himself, Milton suspects.
From the second I got to Andrea, we've been searching. Decades. Centuries.
We haven't stopped, not completely. but we don't have the means to search for her. And these wars and conflicts and fights, we still have people to help. It's an impossible task and an impossible decision, the Partigiano finishes the thought. That he can understand and can feel sorry for. It's hard to find words after that. The two men wallow in silence for a minute or two before Milton musters enough willpower to break it. I don't think I can go back to sleep. The admission is a tiny little thing, but it's enough to pull a sympathetic smile out of Joseph. Me neither. But we should still try. He lays his head back down on the makeshift straw pillow and motions for Milton to join him, tired smile still in place as the Partigiano turns to fully face him. Do you want to hear a bedtime story? The idea seems absurd, to be put to sleep like a child after such a loaded conversation, but Milton, exhausted by his own whirling mind, welcomes the distraction. He doesn't know how long it lasts, but Joseph weaves him a tale from his boyhood, a story involving stolen dates, a disgruntled older sister, a vat of red dye, and a cat. The two of them are stifling giggles by the end of it, and Milton can't help but admire how skilled the other man is in distracting and amusing. Maybe he should speak to Frank about sending him on an undercover reconnaissance mission one of these days. Knows Joseph, in all his eagerness to help, would be thrilled to be useful. The older man's childhood adventure is quite a journey, but it still leaves them both trapped in wakefulness. Your turn, Joseph says. They are so close his breath brushes against Milton's cheeks. Tell me a story. I'm no good with stories. He thought his previous life to be as uneventful as they come, and the memory of his younger years is quite faint. The other man's dimples seem to deepen under Milton's gaze. Sing me a lullaby, then. Eyebrows raising, the Partigiano stares at him for a beat, before realizing he is completely serious. He raises his head to take a quick look around the room and make sure his wine-addled companions are still dead to the world. Joseph looks at him expectantly, inching even closer. Well, why not? Have you seen that Wizard of Oz movie from a couple of years ago? Joseph shakes his head, a stray curl falling on his face. No, but I've heard of it. Truth be told, Milton hadn't either. There was only one little cinema in his town when it was released in Italy, and they hadn't been able to get their hands on a reel of the film. But Fulvia had. She bought the record with her favorite song from it, and the two of them had heard it so, so many times. The first notes echo inside his head already. He takes a deep breath and just lets the lyrics flow out. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. There's a tremble in his voice as he tries to be as quiet as possible. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. The English falls from his mouth with ease, despite him having ignored the language for months now, his tongue automatically forming the words. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why, then, oh, why can't I? If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why, oh, why can't I? Breathing out that last line, he's transported to Fulvia's library. Just for a second, surrounded by the scent of old books and aged wood, watching her and Giorgio glide across the floor in front of him to another song with longing in his heart. He remembers Fulvia's own words to describe the song. When it ends, I feel as if something truly ends. He can see the truth in them now. The smile is gone from Joseph's face. That strange glint returned to his eyes as Milton finishes, leaving the Partigiano exposed under his gaze. Beautiful, the older immortal says. His voice is gruff, and that, coupled with Milton's heavy eyelids, signals a long-awaited drowsiness. Joseph lets out a satisfied hum, eyes slowly sliding shut. Thank you for the song, Milton. He lays his hand in the small space left between them, reaching out but not daring to touch. The other man looks at it, looks at Joseph's relaxed features, at the complete trust the man has exhibited when it comes to him. He covers that hand with his own. Niccolo, he whispers. My name is Niccolo. Eyes still closed, Joseph touches his forehead to Niccolo's, fingers intertwining. In a few days, the Partigiano will write a tear-stained letter to his parents. He'll write to Giorgio's father, too, and this one he'll deliver in person and tell the elder Clerici everything already put to paper. He'll write to Fulvia, to her new home in Turin. In less than 2 years, Milan will be liberated by the people, and the two immortals will leave Italy knowing they did something to help. They'll make their way further into Europe in search of the others, and on their long journey, Joseph will tell him about his past, his death, the places he's been. He'll tell him about a warrior named Andromache and the battle she fought, a feisty pit viper named Quinn and her exploits, a forger named Sebastian and the sadness behind his eyes, a fallen friend he never met named Lycan, the first of them to ever die and not come back. He'll tell him all one day, and Niccolo will wholly and gladly return the favor. But for now, the two immortals are content to simply lie side by side, knowing they won't have to face the future alone. The end.